there be chaos on Election Day? Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, how to ensure a safe and secure election here in Florida in November. We'll speak with an elections expert and take your calls, too. It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later, are you concerned about all of those single-use plastics we've all been using in this pandemic? A new report says we can reduce even right now. But first this hour, here is the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. 665,730 cases of coronavirus in Florida and 12,642 deaths, with 547 deaths reported from COVID-19 here in our area of the state. Now, as this pandemic drags on, we are just a few weeks away from the start of early voting in Florida. Many will be voting early and doing mail-in balloting to avoid exposure to the virus. Florida, of course, has spent tens of millions beefing up election security since the 2016 election. Every county has been audited. There are now 5 full-time cyber specialists working for the state. And as we draw closer to Election Day, we learn this week from Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward in his new book, Rage, that both Washington and St. Lucie counties were indeed hacked by Russian malware in 2016. At the same time, a coalition of groups here in Florida and around the country is working on a series of responses if, as some fear, there's chaos on or after Election Day, if we don't have a clear result, or even, as some fear, if the president says the election is invalid and refuses to leave if he were to lose. Ian Sancho is the retired supervisor of elections from Leon County. He's been studying all of this, and he's on the line. Ian, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us, and here's our question to callers. What are your biggest concerns about election security? How do you plan to vote in the November elections? We'll go to your calls in a few minutes. The number to join us, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Now, Ian, in a moment, I do want to ask you about this new group, the Transition Integrity Project. It's actually a coalition of groups looking at how to avoid a disaster in the November election, as many fear. But first, I want to ask you about the revelations in Bob Woodward's book. You're a former supervisor of elections for Leon County. Woodward has reported that both Washington County in the Panhandle and St. Lucie County, south of Jacksonville, of course, were indeed hacked by Russian malware in 2016. So we're told that no votes were changed or manipulated. Still, though, it's an unsettling revelation as we get closer to November. What are your biggest concerns about election security in Florida this time?
Well, my biggest concerns are what we don't know. I know that the state has spent millions and supervisor of elections has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on security issues. But most of those are at the front end, buying Albert sensors, hardening their sites. And again, the issue here is what is going to happen on November the 3rd. And quite frankly, I think Florida is ahead of the curve in many, many respects. Unlike Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, where they are not allowed to start processing their vote-by-mail ballots until Election Day, Florida has over 20 days in which we're going to be processing them. So unlike those states, which may take a full week or more to tabulate their mail-in ballots, Florida should have their votes tabulated by Tuesday, November the 3rd. It might be late, but we'll get them done that evening. And that'll give us some clarity in terms of this election. And I think many of the individuals that I've talked to have concerns, which quite frankly are stirred by the national debate and not looking at the Florida-centric process that we have here. I think Florida actually is in good shape for the election. The supervisors of elections know how to process the mail ballots. Our error rate generally is 1% or less, which is better than many states in the country. For example, California, the tabulation there, it was almost 2% of all of their vote-by-mail ballots were rejected. And again, I think that this is a very trying time for election officials, but Florida is actually positioned better than I think most of the states in the nation. In terms of the revelations from Bob Woodward's book, it was very surprising. I've talked to supervisor of elections, Gertrude Walker, and she was completely unaware.
That's St. Lucie County?
That's St. Lucie County. And so this is very troubling. And again, this whole issue of the Russian GRU attack on the state of Florida and what transpired is an issue that, quite frankly, I think has been handled completely wrong by the federal government. In my own opinion, secrecy only helps those who are incompetent or the corrupt. And in the area of elections, we need transparency. We don't know what happened in those counties. There's been no information relative to the level of penetration, the remediation that occurred, and quite frankly, that's a mistake. And I think the federal government has made a mistake in this whole process of attempting to hide from election officials what was done. And the federal government deliberately hid information from election officials. I myself was on a telephone call on September 30th in 2016 when the FBI and Homeland Security, on a statewide conference call with all the election officials, gave us false information about these penetrations. So quite frankly, that's something that I think the election officials and our department who handles security needs to do much better job. We need to know what, why, and how. And quite frankly, the only people that don't know that are the public.
Yeah,
and it's
exactly.
Time that we,
so many questions.
Yeah,
we all have so many questions, and I'm so glad to have you because you are a retired supervisor of elections. We'll go to your calls in a moment for Ian Sancho at 549-2937. So many questions, Ian. Mail ballots go out in 2 weeks in Florida on September 24th. More than 2.6 million have already been requested. Many of you out there plan to vote by mail, both Democrats, Republicans, and independents. As you pointed out, Ian, Florida has a very good system for counting those ballots so that they will have a definitive result, we hope, on election night. We keep hearing that in order to really be confident about your vote, you need to hand in a hand-marked paper ballot. In Jacksonville, we do vote by paper ballot. That isn't the case in other precincts around the state, though. And when you talk to election supervisors, they'll say, well, none of these machines are connected to the internet. Your vote is secure, even if it's a digital touchscreen vote. I think it's fair to say there's a lot of cynicism about that among the electorate. They know that modems, for example, can have backdoors to the internet. They're worried, they're cynical about their vote being manipulated, even though we don't know for sure that that might happen. As a retired election supervisor, what's your assessment of this whole issue when it comes to our ballot?
Well, I will tell you that for the most part, we do vote on paper ballots, hand-marked paper ballots in the state of Florida, except those jurisdictions that use ballot marking devices made by one particular company, the ES&S company out of Omaha, Nebraska. And quite frankly, I'm very skeptical about voting using ballot marking devices because those machines are not counting the votes of the voters. They're counting the votes of the machine because they're digital. They take pictures, and that's what was the fight that occurred earlier this month over the issue of keeping the digital images of the ballots. And fortunately, the lawsuit has been settled. Those digital images will be kept because if you're using a ballot marking device, the machine is actually tabulating not the mark of a voter, but the mark of another machine, and that therein lies the problem. You're looking at a machine, counting a machine's vote that was marked by a human's vote. And that intermediary issue, quite frankly, is something we're going to have to deal with in the future. But the paper ballots that we do use here allow for an excellent count. Unfortunately, our recount provision will not do that. Florida does not have any kind of auditing process or recount process that verifies that the electronic totals actually, in fact, match the voters' hand marks on those ballots. That's something that we're going to have to deal with in the future. I think that the United States as a nation has not audited its ballots at all. I can name on one hand the states that properly conduct an audit to confirm the validity of those totals, and Florida is not in that handful of states that do that. That's something that we'll have to deal with in the future. But Florida does have a ballot inspection law that can be used. So if we believe that there are errors with the machine count, any citizen can actually ask for a ballot inspection, and all of the ballots cast in election have to be presented, if that's the individual's or organizational's wish. That is what the media consortium did to do the recount in for the 2000 election, mm-hmm. the ballot inspection law. So there is a backstop to all of this, that if we're concerned or citizens are concerned that there's some kind of funny business that went down in the count, we can actually invoke, county by county, a ballot inspection law, and this is separate from a recount.
Interesting.
So there are protections. There's not been a ballot recount inspection in the state of Florida since 2001. So again, I would say many supervisors may not even be aware of the ballot inspection law, but it may come into play if there are questions relative to vote tabulations in some of our counties.
All right.
But we do have that protection.
That's interesting to know. And let's go to some calls now for Ian Sandshow, perhaps the foremost expert on elections in this state. He's frequently called on to give his analysis. He's the retired supervisor of elections for Leon County. What are your questions about election security? 549-2937. Russell on the west side. Hi, Russell. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Melissa. Well, the rundown. So we had the mentioned interference from Russia in 2016. The former Soviet Union, our former sworn blood enemy for 45 years. After that, we had the Battle of Charlottesville that took place. We've had this rise of so-called fake news. And then more recently, Q, whoever Q is. Now we've got, you know, people like this clown Caputo up there with anti-science fake science.
Yeah, you're talking about a Trump administration staffer that made some unsubstantiated allegations of around the election. Yeah, so you're right, Russell. There's a lot of crazy stuff out there, and I think it's contributing to this sense of unease that many voters have. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yes. Haven't we seen sort of a very low intensity conflict for the last 4 years?
Okay, Russell, thank you for that call. Ian Sandshow, I think Russell speaks to the angst and anxiety many voters on both sides of the aisle feel. They are concerned about this election. They're concerned we won't have a definitive result on election night. The partisans on both sides fear the other side will try to cheat. There is a new organization called the Transition Integrity Project. It's a bipartisan group of people working to identify the most serious risks to our democracy in case there's chaos on or after election night. They're gaming out. It's sort of like war games. They're gaming out a series of elections and transition scenarios to ensure an orderly transfer of power no matter who wins the election. And so how do you speak to those anxieties, Ian?
Well, I think, first of all, these attacks on our system are exactly what the foreign interveners are attempting to do, to get people to doubt, to sow the seeds of doubt in this process. That's part of what this disinformation campaign is all about. And if you're following social media, you've seen the thousands of bots and sites that Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram have been pulling off, because quite frankly, the social media sites are rife with false information. Section 203 of the FCC code provides a blanket exemption so that social media companies are not responsible and can't be held responsible for what they broadcast. That's going to have to be addressed, because quite frankly, we need to know what the truth is. And individuals should really take what they read on the internet with a huge grain of salt, because quite frankly, that's where our enemies are living on. They're living on social media, and they're attempting to sow discord and fear about the process and doubt. And I think one of the things that we have to realize is that every election official in this country is working to ensure that the process works well. And I think we can't be sure that the election will end on November the 3rd, primarily because of the huge volume of vote-by-mail ballots. I'm sorry, but unless the laws are dramatically changed in Pennsylvania and Michigan, they will not be able to process millions of ballots. They're battleground states, and those states may be necessary. So I think we need to understand that the election may not be settled on Tuesday, and there is no conspiracy with that. It's because so many millions of people have decided to vote by mail who have never done so. And I'm one of those individuals. I'm immunocompromised. The only way I could vote in the primary was to request a vote-by-mail ballot, and I dropped it off at a vote-by-mail drop box in front of an early voting station, which is exactly a very convenient process. I didn't have to really interact with any other people, and the election officials collect those ballots at those drop boxes nightly. Every urban jurisdiction that I'm aware of in the state of Florida has a tracking system. I know it was introduced in Leon County in 2008, and this tracking system would allow us, any voter that voted by mail, to go to the elections website and determine whether or not their ballot had been received by the elections office and whether it had been counted. Mm. And so that's one of the things that I would urge citizens to do is monitor the Supervisor of Elections website. Look at the quality of the information. Can you track your ballot? That's critical. And again, there are many ways to vote. You can request a vote-by-mail ballot, but under Florida law, you're not required to vote that way. So a vote-by-mail ballot for many people is like an insurance policy. You can request it and get it and use it, putting it in the mail. But if you do that, I would request that you put it in the mail at least 2 weeks before the election date, given the problems that are now apparent.
I've heard of people who did that in the primary election. They gave it 2 weeks. They tracked the ballot. And because of the slowdowns at the Postal Service, some people have told me their ballots didn't get there in time, even with 2 weeks lead time. That doesn't instill a lot of confidence, I have to say. But let me get to a few more calls for you as we speak with elections security expert and retired Leon County Supervisor of Elections, Ian Sancho. What are your questions about election security, voting by mail, and more? 549-2937, May on the South Side. Hi, May. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great, thanks. Yeah, go ahead.
It was a three-part, turned into a four-part question. Number one, Ivanka Trump has voting machine patents. Are those allowed to be used in this election? That's number one. Number two, Dade Broward in the 2016, had an issue with their voting tabulation machine that was so bad they were not able to recount, and they had to go with their initial count of the vote. Also, number three is, why can we not have our supervisors of elections run like a trial run to see if these machines are working correctly, and especially in counties like Dade Broward that had issues in 2016? And I forgot number four.
If you think of it, call us back. Okay, May. All right. So let's take those one by one, Ian, beginning with the Ivanka Trump branded voting machines that she does have. I believe those are overseas, though. Let's begin with that and then address her other questions, if you could.
Yes, the Chinese machines that she acquired the rights to are not used in the United States. The machines that we use here are in the state of Florida, are by two vendors, the ES&S company and the Dominion company. They're both here in North America. They're not foreign companies. And so there won't be any of those devices used. These devices have been used many times. As far as I can see, these machines have been well verified over many, many, many years of use. However, poor administration can wreck good machines. And that's exactly what happened in Broward County. There, the supervisor of elections, who ultimately lost her position, was quite frankly not up to the job of supervising a county that's larger than many of the voting populations of states in this country. And that a series of errors were continually happening in that county. And so even if you have excellent machines, you have to have excellent administration, the proper number of citizen individuals that you've hired to process those ballots. And frankly, that was not the case in Broward County. She's been replaced. They've beefed up the office. We have an individual who has no elections experience, but is supposedly a good manager. And so we'll see how that works out. Lack of experience in a presidential election is troubling, because I can tell you, unless you have administered a presidential election, you have no idea what's coming. It's a tidal wave unlike anything I have ever experienced. And I used to joke with my staff and tell them, every time we conducted a presidential election, I lost the year of my life, simply because the stress is incredible.
I can imagine.
Any error could disenfranchise someone's right to vote.
Yeah.
And so you can really you can't miscount the number of ballots you distribute. For example, if you think you're going to have an 80% vote by mail, so you only plan for 20% of the precincts, and you only get 60% of the people voting by mail. Do you have enough paper ballots to cover your erroneous algorithm, for example? So that's why you have to have excess supplies. Many people say, well, that's waste. Excuse me. It's a greater waste if someone's right to vote is lost. That is an irreplaceable loss. So I think the situation has been improved in South Florida. The technology that led to Palm Beach not being able to count their ballots on time in the rescan, the Sequoia machines, they've been banned. They're no longer in use anywhere in the state of Florida. And quite frankly, as far as I know, they're only used in California in this time. And California has 28 days to certify their election, so they don't need to run the machines 24/7 the way Florida was using those Sequoia optical scan machines. So I think the machine issue and the supervisor of elections issue go hand in hand. You can't have an excellent product for the citizens unless the supervisor of elections does a diligent job anticipating all of the potential problems, allowing all of the voting groups that are unique to the community to have access to the right to vote. And then you have to have trained individuals that know how to operate the machines properly. And humans make mistakes. Humans make mistakes. That's unfortunately, as Shakespeare said, to err is human.
That's right.
So you've got to have safeguards to check against human failure.
And with this election, I think more than ever, I just want to point out there are lots of comments on our Facebook page. Jim writes, don't wait until election day. Vote early. Drop off your ballot at the elections office or an early voting site. Don't wait until the last day. He says,
I agree.
And you agree with that as early as possible?
Absolutely. Well, for two reasons. If you're going to be voting by mail, the only way we can verify that the vote is valid and every vote is verified in the state of Florida is we're going to compare the signature on the affidavit envelope, which is the outside envelope that you mail the ballots back to the elections office. We compare that signature with the signature that's on the voter registration form to make sure it's the same person. And quite frankly, that is one source of error right there. Individuals, for example, can register to vote in the state of Florida at the age of 16, early registration, even though they can't vote until 18. And we find a large number of citizens who have registered to vote while they were in high school. Those signatures dramatically change when they become older Americans, when they're working in a job, when they're in college. And so if you're an individual that has registered to vote, and if you've never voted by mail before, you might want to do an address update, which means you just need to go to the state website, download the Florida voter registration application, and there's a box on it called Signature Update. Fill out that form and mail it to your supervisor of elections office, and that will be the signature that you're going to be verifying that absentee ballot again. So this is one whole category of problems that make up the 1% rejections. And the other is that ballot arriving too late. If it arrives after 7 p.m. on election night, it can't be tabulated the way it can, for example, in other states. In Arizona, you have almost 3 weeks to verify that ballot if you're a voter, to correct any mistakes. In California, 28 days. In Oregon, 14 days. The state of Florida says you only have 48 hours after the election to make a cure, to correct a signature problem that doesn't look like it matches, which is one of the shortest timeframes in the nation, unfortunately.
Right. So in other words, if you want to make sure your vote counts, the earlier the better.
And right, if you bring it in earlier, then you can find out and correct that problem.
And correct the problem.
You don't have to worry.
So, Ian, we're getting tweets from listeners, too, that are worried about what might happen if President Trump loses the election. Here's one listener. He's not afraid to call for violence if it can help retain his power. That's my reference to the earlier coalition of groups called the Transition Integrity Project, gaming out worst case scenarios in case there is an uncertain result on election night and there's a fight over the results that drags on for weeks. And to be clear, there are those on the right that fear the same from the Biden-Harris campaign. Each side is afraid that the other side will try dirty tricks to somehow steal the election, since we are not likely to have a definitive result on election night. What are your final thoughts about that?
Well, I think, quite frankly, Florida could end the election, depending upon how it goes. Because clearly when you look at the Electoral College, and that's what we use to elect the president, that President Trump cannot win without Florida. Candidate Biden can win without Florida. So it depends on who wins Florida on November the 3rd will be determinative, in my opinion, of who wins the election. Secondly, I think that I'm actually taking a page from the Trump supporters who are saying, why are you taking the president literally? And that's exactly what his supporters say. That's why they're not upset about these things. I think one of the things that the president has established is he sows chaos with his verbal messages. I don't think they're serious, quite frankly. I think they're just pronouncements to make the hair catch on fire of a people who don't support him. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, I think I don't listen to his words. I only pay attention to actions, and I do not believe that our entire apparatus would tolerate someone not following the Constitution so directly. I'm not concerned that, in fact, there are going to be individuals who will go into armed conflict and not want to follow the law. I think the bulk of our institutions would ensure that, in fact, the laws are followed, faithfully followed. And the election cannot be set aside. It's in the Constitution. That authority does not reside in the executive branch. And I think that we don't have to worry about some of the more crazier pronouncements that are coming from the president's mouth. I think we just need to focus on doing the job, getting citizens to vote, and counting those votes correctly, and let that determine the outcome of the election.
Always so good to get your insights. He is election expert and retired Leon County Supervisor of Elections, Ian Sancho. Ian, thanks as always.
You're quite welcome.
And go to wjct.org/elections for complete election coverage now and leading up to November 3rd. Much more still ahead later. Inside Jax is Rad. We'll tell you about it. But up next,
the report, Reusables Are Doable, shows that around the world, reuse and refill systems have continued to be or can be used safely during the COVID-19 pandemic.
How to cut down on those single-use plastics, even in this pandemic. Plus, how you can support WJCT. Here's how.
I'm Tim Mack, NPR's Washington investigative correspondent. Public radio serves as a link between you and elected officials, keeping our government responsible for its promises and for its actions. Getting the story right requires many steps, but once you decide to support this kind of rigorous journalism, making the leap from listener to new member is easy. Here's how to donate to this station.
please call 353-9528 or visit wjct.org.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9. Welcome back. A quarter of young adults between the ages of 18 and 24 say they've considered suicide during this pandemic. It paints a bleak picture of the nation's mental health in this crisis. And more than 40% of those surveyed say they've experienced a mental or behavioral health problem connected to the COVID-19 emergency. September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and behavioral health experts at LSF Health Systems in Jacksonville recently were awarded a significant federal grant to work with local patients in ERs and domestic violence shelters. And the goal is to help lower suicide rates on the First Coast. To learn more, I spoke with Dr. Christine Caulfield, CEO of LSF Health Systems in Jacksonville. Dr. Caulfield, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
You know, as this pandemic drags on, I know you're looking at data that shows a real issue when it comes to the mental health of people in our area. Calls to hotlines are up. Domestic abuse shelters are seeing more people coming in. Overdoses are higher. Suicide rates are rising. So tell us about this new coalition that you're a part of to address these issues. What's happening with this?
Yes. Well, at LSF Health Systems, we were very grateful to receive a SAMHSA grant. It's the new COVID-19 Emergency Response for Suicide Prevention Project. And it's a partnership among local organizations that include LSF Health Systems, the Mental Health Resource Center, Hubbard House, and Changing Homelessness, and Baptist Emergency Room. And the goal of the project is to prevent suicide attempts among adults who are at risk, including victims of domestic violence. And the project will screen up to 1,200 individuals in the 16-month grant period and also provide intensive care coordination to the participants, again, over the 16-month period. So We're really focusing on high-risk individuals to prevent suicide.
So important to catch people before they make that horrible decision. And who in our community, what category of people would you say is most at risk? Who are you looking out for the most?
You know, we really are seeing that younger adults are higher risk, those with racial and ethnic minorities, essential workers, you know, those folks that are frontline, not only the folks that are frontline in medical centers and hospital ERs, but also our behavioral health care frontline workers, and unpaid adult caregivers, those that are caring for somebody that is critically ill, perhaps has COVID or has Alzheimer's. Those unpaid caregivers have really had a sharp increase in their suicidal ideation, their depression, and their anxiety as a result of the isolation and other effects of this pandemic.
No surprise to hear that. And so in your world of behavioral health, you use the term crisis fatigue. People are just hitting a wall with this, it sounds like.
It's very true. People are almost at the end of their rope, if you will. They're reporting that, you know, they had false hope that in the summertime, you know, the heat would kill the virus and things would be opening up, and that has not happened throughout our nation. And people are really missing the connection, missing the ability to interact with their colleagues at work, for example, feeling overly stressed with kids that are still home and have been homeschooling and perhaps dealing with their elderly parents as well. You know, some of our folks have lost their jobs and, you know, subsequently losing their insurance. And there's just so many additional stressors on individuals today than ever before.
There really are. So as your suicide prevention team and this coalition reaches out to people in crisis, what's your advice for all of the rest of us as we try to maintain our mental and emotional health right now? It is really challenging. Even if you have a good job, a lot of support, you're healthy, this is just a challenging time for everyone, isn't it?
It really is. And it's so important for self-care. We've got to be mindful that, you know, in these times of severe crisis and unknowingness, if you will, that we've got to balance our fears. We've got to balance the anxiety and depression that we may be experiencing with factoring in self-care. We've got to really be mindful of our eating habits, making sure that we are fueling our bodies with healthy foods. We have to make sure that we're getting enough rest. And it might be time, if you are experiencing sleepless nights, to get some help, get some sleeping aids at this time so that you can get a good night's sleep. You know, a lot of people are coping with unhealthy strategies such as drinking more alcohol, taking, you know, illicit drugs, and this certainly is only going to increase depression and cause a host of other issues. So really be mindful of your alcohol intake. Exercise is also critical, and getting outside, even if it's just a 10-minute break outdoors, take a little walk. We really have to factor in those healthy types of coping strategies so that we can counteract the negative effects that this pandemic is causing for a lot of people.
Great. Great advice from Dr. Caulfield. Thanks for that. Well, after months of the plastic industry pushing single-use plastics to stay safe in this pandemic, there's a new report out looking at reuse and refill solutions around the world. David Pinsky is the senior plastics campaigner at Greenpeace USA, and he's the author of this report, Reusables Are Doable. Take a listen. David Pinsky, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
I'm excited to hear more about this new Greenpeace report, Reusables Are Doable. We're all interested, I think, in reducing the amount of disposable plastics that we're putting out into the world. What did you find? What is this report showing?
So the report, Reusables Are Doable, shows that around the world, reuse and refill systems have continued to be or can be used safely during the COVID-19 pandemic. And this is despite the plastic industry's efforts to push widespread disposables. These systems can instill confidence and ensure strong sanitization or contactless systems for cups and containers that make it both convenient and safe for workers and customers alike. And the COVID-19 pandemic does not need to mean shifting toward widespread single-use plastic that threatens our environment, communities, and health.
That's such an important message because, of course, people are so afraid of the virus. So they have been relying on a lot of single-use plastics, particularly when they maybe get food delivered to their home. So what are some examples of alternatives that we can learn about?
So one I mentioned was contactless systems. So we're seeing, take for example, Starbucks, unfortunately not here in North America just yet, but abroad in Europe and the Middle East and its African markets, contactless coffee systems. So these are being embraced not just by Starbucks abroad, by also hundreds of cafes worldwide to minimize waste. And it's a pretty simple system. Folks take in their reusable cup to a cafe, they place it on a tray, they back away so they can ensure proper social distancing. And then a barista will take that cup, go fill it up, and then return it to the customer. So there are some pretty basic systems like that where you can bring your own container. Here in the U.S., Loop is a well-known startup that is expanding not just throughout the U.S. but globally, and that offers well-known grocery brands to customers in reusable containers. And those get delivered to your home, then you use those containers and send them back to Loop, which uses strong sanitization systems. And then, Melissa, here in Florida, Miami-based startup EcoPod uses vending machines, so folks can use a reusable container and they can refill at those vending machines for personal care and cleaning products. And EcoPod's starting to work with some large consumer brands like Unilever. So as we see more of these investments and more of this uptake and expansion, we're going to find even more reuse and refill systems available and at a good price point, so it's also affordable for folks nationwide.
And I think there are so many people here in North Florida that would like access to these products. Now, you mentioned Loop. People can, in some communities, use that to have their groceries delivered, for example. I don't believe that's currently available in North Florida. For example, if I use Instacart or Shipt to have food delivered to my home from, say, Publix or another grocery store, it's coming in either paper or plastic bags. So what can we as consumers do to let retailers know that we want them to segue more into this kind of reusable product?
Yeah, great question. So Loop is only available right now working with retailers like Kroger and Walgreens. So certainly we need to see more expansion on some of these systems, but for Publix or Winn-Dixie or Harvey's or Target or Walmart, a great way to exercise your voice as a customer is and ensure social distancing is to on social media you can tag the companies, ask what they're doing to tackle the plastic pollution crisis, and provide goods in reuse systems. You can also give them a phone call or write them if you go to their websites and their customer service lines or email addresses. So that's a great way to let your voice be heard. And we absolutely need to see big names in Florida like Publix take leadership by not only eliminating single-use plastics in their operations, but switching to these reuse and refill systems of the future.
And you estimate a $10 billion economic opportunity if we were to replace just 20% of single-use plastic packaging with reusable alternatives. So changing habits is hard, changing business models is hard, but there is an opportunity in this pandemic if it does, in the end, bring about this new reuse model. How do you see that unfolding?
Exactly. And so that figure is based on a study by the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, and they were looking at if only, I believe it was 20% of single-use plastics were being replaced with reuse systems. So then, you know, times that by five and perhaps even more in 2020 figures. So that's a huge opportunity, not just for businesses, but we really need to look at also the workers. And certainly during the pandemic, we've seen a lot of upheaval, not just in retail, but of course in restaurants and food service. So this, if we look at expanded reuse and refill systems, we can not only help protect our health, our community's health, in the environment, but also ensure that workers are getting into good union jobs. So, you know, again, Melissa, this really requires an investment from large businesses. So I mentioned Publix, we need to see that leadership. Walmart, that's getting ready to launch its competitor to Amazon called Walmart Plus for online delivery. You know, these companies are making billions of dollars in profits, and when they are investing and using just a fraction of that money to move toward these systems, that's when we're going to start to see a sea change.
And definitely tell your store manager that you'd like to see them move in this direction. They do listen to what customers say. So thank you so much, David. He is the author of the new Greenpeace report, Reusables Are Doable. David Pinsky, good to get your insights. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The U.S. is still recording almost 50,000 new COVID-19 cases a day and about 1,000 new deaths. But where are those cases occurring and why? We'll look at the current hotspots in the U.S. and around the world and continue our coverage of House races this November with a profile of a close contest in Pennsylvania. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Big changes in energy markets can mean big changes in foreign policy. The U.S. shale explosion, for example?
We have flexibility to deal with Iran that we didn't have before because the Iranians thought that, you know, they had the high cards because the world couldn't do without their oil.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Energy meets geopolitics again. That's next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 here on WJCT News 89.9.
The first Stars and Stripes rolled off the presses in 1861. Around 1 million American troops read the paper every day. The institution was going to be shut down, but then the order by the Pentagon to pull funding was rescinded late last week. As November nears, what news matters most for those on active duty whose service keeps us safe? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Jax is rad, literally and figuratively. And now the folks behind Jax is rad are shining a light on artists, musicians, and other cultural standouts who help make this city great. It's in their new bi-monthly publication, Rad Times. Ansley Randall of Jax is Rad is on the line now. Ansley, good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on the show. And I loved the new publication. How did you come up with the idea for Rad Times?
Oh my gosh. I was trying to think of how this all came about. I've always thought about doing a publication and I just wanted to do something positive in the city. I think this year has been such a hard year and especially it's been hard for creatives and everybody I talked to was just like, we've all struggled, and I just want to do a fun piece that was all about the good news that's going on in Jacksonville and just supporting fellow creatives.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah. Creatives and business owners. So where can people pick up Rad Times around town, and what will they see inside the pages?
Yeah, so I made 10,000 copies, but all of we were all laughing. We're like, we just did 10,000 copies of Rad Times, which is crazy. But they're all around town, like emphasizing on putting them around just like local businesses and coffee shops. And we put them everywhere. And I still have more that I'll put out to around. But everywhere I've been, I'm just like, I've just put them there. So mostly, I mean, they're all, yeah, every coffee shop out there, they have them.
And people need to just look for them. It's a free publication, of course. And what are some of the stories and people you highlight?
So, let's see. Nico, she's a muralist. We did an article on her. We have Blockgate. We talked about them, their business, and Mike Peterson, who's a pro skater. And Garrett Mantle, he wrote both of those articles. He's really into the skate scene and really wanted to step up and highlight just creatives. And Nico also has been painting skate parks, and so it kind of all ties together. And then we've interviewed even fans and like how COVID affected them, new music that's come out. There's all kinds of stuff. And there's even, I have a guinea pig named Trudy. You have to find Trudy in the publication.
Cute.
There's also, we have an advice column from Ben Young, who he's 21 and he gave his honest advice. So it's just silly advice.
Sounds like lots of fun stuff. So this is in accordance with your brand, Jax is Rad. Tell us a little bit more about what that's all about.
Yeah, well, I mean, you said it even at the beginning, is our mission is shine a light on artists, musicians, and local businesses. And it's the same thing, I guess, with Rad Times. Is all I want to do at the end of the day is be an encouragement for others. And especially in Jacksonville, it's just hard. It's hard to be an artist here. And I just wanted to, like, step up and be that encouragement and light in our city. So we have, you know, our Instagram, Facebook, social media, and then we also, not this year, but we usually plan out events bringing community together and creatives, and we also market for other businesses, and we're essentially all made up. There's about, like, six of us, so we're all creatives, and we all just run this together, and so we all, yeah, graphic designers, artists, skaters, there's all kinds of us, but we just wanted to step up and do something for our community that was different.
Sure. Now, with this new issue of Rad Times out now, are you already working on the next one?
We are, yes. You know it. We have, I think we're going to do it every 2 months just to keep like a balance, even in my life, because I paint murals and make patterns too. So it's just, I think our next one will be out in October.
And free, of course. So people need to keep their eye out for it. You can also go to jaxisrad.com, a platform shining a light on artists, musicians, and local businesses who make this city special. Designer Ansley Randall is the creator of Jax Is Rad and also the new free publication, Rad Times, on newsstands now all over town. So pick one up. Ansley, congratulations. Thanks so much for all that you've
done
to add to the life and culture of this city.
So sweet. Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. And to all of our guests and callers, we thank you. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our Rad show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield runs our digital op. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We really appreciate the feedback. And make sure to catch our rebroadcast of this show tonight at 8 o'clock or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We will connect with you again right here at 9 a.m. tomorrow. So have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.